And we can turn it around, and one of the ways we can turn it around, we think, is to have greener cities. Well, what does that actually look like? Many of us would not think of Manhattan when we think of sort of eco-utopia, and yet that's exactly the example that David Owen starts out in his new book, Green Metropolis, with, and really challenging some of the beliefs that many people working for environmental progress have been sounding for many years. So a very timely book, especially as our population nears 300 million in this country and more than 6 billion globally. We do have environmental and energy needs that are going to have to be looked at in a very fresh and real and honest way. We can't afford too many detours. So very important book, and I'm very thrilled to have David Owen on the Green Front with us today. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, so you've written, I guess, about a dozen books. What made you decide to focus on environmental issues for this one?
Well, it was just kind of arose out of an examination of my own life. My wife and I got married 32 years ago, and for the first 7 years that we were married together, we lived in a utopian environmentalist community in New York State. We had just about 700 square feet of living space. We didn't own a car or a clothes dryer or we didn't have a lawn to water, and we did almost all our shopping on foot, and when there were places that were too far for us to walk, we took public transportation, and our electric bill worked out to something like a dollar a day. And that utopian community was Manhattan. It was New York City. We were young marriage in New York City. And I never thought of it in that way until we moved to the suburbs, the way people do. And we went from having no cars to having one car, and then realized that when you have one car isn't enough, because when that car is at the mechanic, you are unable to go pick it up.
They don't have shuttle service, huh?
We went from one to two, and then we ended up with three, you know, as a result of a mild midlife crisis on my part. And then that third car became a necessity when our kids got old enough to drive, because the thing you realize when you move out of the city. I think people, city dwellers who picture life in the country, picture people, hiking through the woods and kayaking down rivers and gathering eggs from their own chickens. But what you really do when you move to the country is move into a car, because you're no longer served by public transit. There are no longer destinations that are accessible on foot, and you go from driving, you know, in our case, 0 miles a year to 30,000 miles a year between us.
So we can't all live in cities, even if we want to, even if that is the most eco-friendly way to live, an efficient way to live. How are you proposing that we, you know, learn from the example in Manhattan, which, of course, we should spend a few minutes talking about, because it's very countological, counterintuitive, that a place that is jammed with so much humanity and so much cement and built environment, and if you're lucky, you get to Central Park, you see some green, or as you say, if there's trees on the street, it's more decoration than actual nature. How is that really surprisingly green and in the ecological sense? And then what are you proposing we do, given there's too many of us to all move to Manhattan?
Right. I think the lesson from Manhattan and from other dense cities, from all the old European cities and from places like Hong Kong, which probably has the smallest carbon footprint per capita of any civilized place in the world. Manhattanites, incidentally, have the smallest carbon footprint of any Americans. The lesson is that the way you shrink the energy and carbon footprints of people is by moving them into smaller spaces and moving them closer to one another and to their daily destinations. We have an idea that's really kind of, you know, I'm 55, it's an idea I've grown up with, which is that the only way to have an authentic relationship with nature is to live in contact with it. You have to be direct contact with it. You need to see it directly, but that's really the motive force of sprawl. It's what sends us sort of fleeing beyond our neighbors, and the people who live the most with the smallest impacts are not the people who live at the end of the dirt road, where their entire existence depends on this huge kind of infrastructure, civic infrastructure serving them. But it's the people who live in small apartments without cars, in places that are dense enough that they can walk to the grocery store. And I think that what we, how we apply that lesson is by saying, you know, that when we talk about the need for public transit, it's empty talk unless we're willing to arrange ourselves in ways that make public transit work. It doesn't work in metropolitan Atlanta, in the suburban, this suburban Atlanta covers more square mileage than my entire state, Connecticut. It's huge, and it's basically unservable by public transit. People live too far from each other. You can't run efficient buses or subways. In order to make things like that work, you have to move people close together. I think that the fact about Manhattan that should give us pause is that it's one of the last places in America where walking is a primary mode of transportation for a large percentage of the population. 77% of Manhattan residents don't own even one car, and it's 0% in the rest of the country.
And so what should we do with all the McMansions that have been built and all the suburbs and the sprawl? I mean, because we do have a crisis at hand, I'm really intrigued as to how we can put some of your ideas into practice in a practical way, scalability, if you will.
We're clearly not going to bulldoze Atlanta, for example. But what we need is policies that encourage the growth that we're, you know, this next 100 million people in the United States that we're looking at. That growth ideally should take place in the places that the impact is the least, which is by densifying existing urban places to increase their density. And we should not have policies that encourage it to take place in the places where we encourage it now, which is at the outer edges of where people live. I remember I was in Las Vegas working on a story about water, and talking to someone who had first seen Las Vegas in the 1970s on a vacation with her family, and she said that when they were there, they were staying in the hotel, and she asked, you know, where do the people who work in the hotels live? Do they live in the hotels? Because there was you didn't see then what you see today, which is suburbia spreading as far as you can see across the valley. Las Vegas, until the recession hit it, was one of the fastest growing places in the United States. That kind of growth is like a stone around our neck, because it when we move beyond centers of density, we pull behind us this huge sort of, you know, fuel-consuming, pollutant, carbon-belching machine. That all the roads, all the infrastructure we need, the new roads, new schools, new power distribution, new water treatment facilities, all the new yards that we then water and fertilize. We do better environmentally, globally, when we live closer together.
The New York Times, I'm looking on the back cover of your book, calls you pugnacious and contrarian, or at least this book is. But aren't you really just talking about smart growth?
Well, smart growth is definitely, there are definite ideas, but they're very, very similar. In fact, I mentioned in the book, there's a smart growth website where it talks about what smart growth looks like. And it has to do with moving in business areas, for example, moving the buildings closer together, closer to the sidewalk, so that widening the sidewalks to create more room for pedestrians. And I was talking to someone at the Sierra Club and said, you know, this really sounds a lot like, you know, you're really describing Manhattan. That's what a dense city is like. And their reaction was, well, that's not really the image we want to have. But I think it's important to look at what density, the true environmental value of density, and where it is. You know, the only really successful public transit system in the United States is New York City's. New York City has something like a third of all the public transit passenger miles in the United States. It has half of all the subway stops. And yet, if you read books about public transit, the need for public transit, New York City is very seldom mentioned. When it is, it's only in passing and often sort of dismissively. We like to think about things like, you know, a nice new fancy light rail system for for our city in the northwestern United States. But if you really, you know, if you want to public transit to have value, the people who use it have to live close enough together to make it work. In fact, one of the most significant facts about New York City's public transit system is that many people who live there don't use it. They don't have to because they live close enough to make it possible for that transit to work. It's also possible for them to walk. If you want to see people on the street, don't go to suburbia. You can travel for miles through an American suburb and not see anybody walking outside who isn't either moving between a building and a vehicle or trying to lose weight. And yet, in any weather, at any hour of the day, in a dense city in Europe, in old city in Europe, in downtown Boston, in downtown San Francisco, in Manhattan, there are people out on the street moving under their own power all day long. There's the greenest form of transportation we know.
And continuing with their analysis of Manhattan, because it is so interesting and provocative, I can see where the lower carbon footprint is accurate. Did you study solid waste? On the one hand, I think, you know, with all the restaurants and convenience needs that you have to have living in such a densely populated area, leading to a lot of garbage. At the same time, because most people, I guess, dwell in apartments rather than, you know, 3,000 square foot homes, there might be less solid waste. Did you do any analysis of that?
Yes, and you always see in a city, I mean, nobody who visits New York City isn't struck by, you know, the garbage on the street, and you think, oh, this garbage, these people generate huge amounts of garbage. But actually, New Yorkers, city dwellers, dense city dwellers, generate less solid waste per capita than people who live in suburbs and in the country. And they have less stuff. They have less stuff to throw away. We're more aware of it because it's more concentrated. And it's true of all their impacts. Because we see them all together, all at once, we think of them as this horrible problem. We have to do something about it. We deceive ourselves, and we think that simply by spreading out, we've made that problem go away. In fact, we've made it worse because we've made the problem both harder to see and harder to address. If you took all the 8.2 million residents of Manhattan and of New, I mean, 8.2 million residents of New York City, and spread them out at the population density of Vermont, which is a state that Forbes magazine picked as the greenest in the United States, you would require a land area equivalent to that of the six New England states, so Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, there's probably another one in there, plus New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia. And then, of course, you'd have to find something to do with all the people you are displacing. Spreading people out doesn't reduce their impact on the environment. It just makes that impact harder to see and harder to address. In fact, it greatly increases their impact.
And your argument makes sense, except that our population is growing, and certainly consumption trends have been growing, maybe a little bit slower because of the recession. But that's kind of inherently the problem, isn't it, that what we have called progress and development, you know, and our GDP has measured, you know, new shopping malls and new home sales, all those things that are, you know, good for growth in the economy are not so good for, you know, our ecological bottom line. So assuming that population growth is going to continue, you know, how do we build more metropolises to, you know, put people in?
Well, the population growth and economic growth are the keys, and they're sort of, I think there are two parts to your question. One is how do we do all these good things while maintaining economic growth, and it's difficult.
Yes.
In the past couple of years, the world has done something that not even the most optimistic environmentalists had anticipated, which is that our carbon footprint and energy footprint actually shrank. Globally, starting in 2008, the human carbon footprint actually got smaller.
I'd like to think that's conservation, but isn't that the economic global recession mostly?
Exactly. It wasn't a sudden greening of the global consciousness. It was
my radio show?
But it was the spike in the price of oil and especially the implosion of the global economy. And it's easy to see why, because, you know, factories that are shut down are not spewing anything into the atmosphere. People who have lost their jobs or are worried about losing their jobs, you know, you turn down the heat, you turn off the air conditioner, you stop heating the pool, you don't drive as much, partly because you don't have as many places to go, and then partly also, you know, because you can't afford it.
And you don't shop as much. You don't buy as many pairs of shoes and clothes and things you really don't need.
Exactly. And so the trick, and it's more than a trick, of course, is how do we accomplish that with how do we accomplish the environmentally valuable side of that without the human suffering on the other side of it? And I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think we do. And it goes beyond. It's a very difficult question because all the clamoring when things were at their worst was to push things in the other direction. When the price of oil was high, we didn't say, here, serendipitously, we've been handed this sort of great green accident. We're forcing down our oil consumption just through this price increase. There was not only from politicians, but from consumers, there was demand, you know, we have to do something about the price of oil. We have to push it down. Let's release oil from the National Strategic Reserve. Let's stop collecting state taxes on gasoline. It's from a public policy point of view, no matter who is in the White House or in Congress, it's not clear that there is any possibility of inflicting that sort of thing on ourselves on purpose, because all our instincts are to make it go the other direction. When we feel that pain, we want it to go away.
Well, I've only read the first part of your book, and it is very interesting, and I'm sorry to hear that the answer is not lying behind the first couple of chapters, because that is really the crux of the challenge, isn't it? The 300 million, you know, challenge, 300 million Americans, that is, how can we prosper as a country by using less, buying less, manufacturing less, less overseas, certainly. And has anyone come up with the answer to that? Because that really, when the rubber meets the road, that's really the big question, isn't it?
No, it's the answers are all things that we don't want to hear, and we tend to, I think that especially Americans, we like solutions that involve buying, you know,
and quick fixes.
We'd like to, you know, I gave a talk in Australia of all places where someone said, you know, he asked me what the theme of my talk was going to be, and he said, forget that. He said, just tell me what to buy. Tell me what to buy. And I think it's what we always, you know, tell me what kind of car to buy, and I'll buy
retail
it.
Retail therapy. Can't solve everything.
And we're less interested in hearing answers that involve less. And we're also, I think, very interested in we're very good at disguising what are actually luxury consumption preferences as gifts to humanity, as acts of altruism, and we're willing to eat better tasting eggs, but not necessarily willing to think through all the consequences of our consumption. So it's difficult, and it's not. I think for 8 years during I was listening to the previous segment of the show, and during the Bush administration, it was very easy to be green. All you had to think was, you know, because you could be a purist. There was no chance that of any significant policy actually being undertaken. The difficulty of the past couple of years is not that we have an administration that isn't sympathetic to the ideas, but that we ourselves are conflicted on them. And I think I think some of the most the powerful conflicts over the environment have been conflicts between environmentalists and environmentalists. The initiative to, for example, build huge solar collection areas and solar collection facilities in deserts in the Southwest, the opponents have often, and if not exclusively, been other environmentalists. The same with hydroelectric, which has, you know, hydroelectric power in many ways is our cleanest form of renewable energy, but it also, building dams, maintaining dams, does terrible things to rivers. And so
don't forget about the nuclear question, which makes some environmentalists very schizophrenic.
Exactly, and I think nuclear is where there's a lot of people who worry about carbon end up being powerful nuclear advocates, and there's a strong case. But at the same time, we sort of can't forget all the reasons that we worry about nuclear power, which are perfectly good reasons.
There's the waste and the cost and the water intensive, energy intensive, you know, practices of building nuclear plants, which is probably why we haven't built too many in a long time. We just have a couple minutes left, and I swear I could go on for another hour with you. Maybe we'll have you on again after I finish your book. Very intriguing, and, you know, again, it feels like we're at a time, we're at a critical crossroads in our ecological development, and we just can't afford to take too many detours, can we? And what do you think of the Green Jobs Movement? How far can that take us towards, you know, this new future with a lighter ecological footprint, but keeping people employed and keeping our country sustainable economically?
It's very easy to have a green job. You and I have green jobs now.
Mine doesn't pay, but I hope yours does. Soon it will. Soon it will. Any day.
I think it's sort of it's too easy to repackage almost any job as a green job. The difficulty is not with green jobs, but with brown jobs. And what do we do with the brown jobs? And it's hard when, you know, it's very easy to talk about creating jobs and very hard to talk about retiring jobs that are difficult. I think that the real issue that we haven't come to terms with is the whole idea of economic growth. Is there any form of economic growth that is environmentally benign? And this is a huge question. The United States, between now and mid-century, we're projected to grow in population by about 100 million people. China is too, over that same period. From the point of view of the environment, the world has much more to fear from those 100 million Americans than it does from those 100 million Chinese, because per capita our carbon and energy footprints are greatly exceed theirs.
We're 5% of the world's population. We use 25% of the resources last time I checked.
Exactly. There was a study at MIT, which was a little shaky, maybe statistically, but they determined that the carbon footprint of the average American homeless person was significantly higher than that of the average non-American resident of the world. So we, just by being who we are, living where we do, we're working our way through an extraordinary chunk of the world's resources, not just in terms of energy, but in terms of everything, water,
well,
everything.
We've worked our way through this hour. I'm so sorry we have to say goodbye, but we'll have you back again.
Thank you very much.
Great fuel for thought. David Owen, the book is Green Metropolis. I didn't even get to ask him about all these Priuses in my area of Marin County. Is it just contributing to a new layer of smugness or what for all us pious Prius drivers? We'll get to that next time. If you'd like to catch the entire show, which began with Ed Begley Jr. and Sally Bingham, go to the Green Front. It's thegreenfront.com. Also, let me know what you think of my idea for a green tea party. Email me at betsy@thegreenfront.com. See you next time. In the meantime, have a great green week.